Thanks very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be back here. I will be discussing a lot of different topics in this talk, many of them based on work that I've done the last couple of years. So in order not to constantly refer to myself, I collected all the references here, and then the rest of the talk will be fairly light on references. You're welcome to look at them now or later. I'm going to start a little bit light before moving into a lot of more recent topics. Just to set the stage, I'm starting with a very broad perspective on quantum field theory. Of course, we know that quantum field theory is a very broad unified language that describes many diverse phenomena in physics, and it's had phenomenal successes doing that. And this notwithstanding, it's still very much a work in progress. So just two bullet points to kind of make that point. We're very good at analyzing weakly coupled Lagrangians. We know what the rules are, particularly if they're Feynman rules, and we know how to calculate, although the calculations can be quite hard, but at least we know what the rules of the game are. And sometimes when we do calculations, we find that the answers have hidden structures or hidden simplicity that we maybe didn't expect. So even in the weakly coupled world, we continue learning new things. In the strongly coupled world, things are worse. And as of now, we don't have a completely general and satisfying set of tools for exploring strongly coupled theories. And to some extent, we don't even completely understand what the rules are. And so developing such tools for analyzing strong coupling is a fundamental open problem in the subject. And of course, I don't need to emphasize to this audience that this would have all sorts of great applications to systems that occur in nature. Here are three of my favorites. Confinement in QCD, it's been a motivating problem for us for decades and continues to be. The fractional quantum Hall effect. We have some cartoon of the Laughlin state where electrons fractionalize into three quasi-particles. It's kind of like the condensed matter analog of QCD and confinement. We keep learning new things by studying the system. And the phase diagram of the humble water, where at least you went all the way to the tricritical point, you would find an interesting interacting conformal field theory, the Ising CFT, that we would also like to understand much better than we do now. Okay, so just to bash on Lagrangians a little bit more, they're great at weak coupling, and they get rapidly less great at strong coupling. And that's not just a technical issue, it's also a conceptual issue, because Lagrangians are, in a sense, not fundamental. Even at weak coupling, as I said, they can obscure symmetries. So famous example is the Yangian in planar n equals to 4, which acts on scattering amplitudes and all sorts of other observables.
Does that still belong? I mean, there's a paper, which I hope that somebody will tell me is correct.
The Beiser paper,
which claims that the Lagrangian can prove the Yangian.
Well, that's a beautiful paper. I'm trying to understand it better. Part of the point of the paper is divesting yourself of the Lagrangian even at weak coupling. But instead coming up with a set of rules or ward-like identities that would replace it. Motivated by the Lagrangian, yes. Of course, we should try to marry all of these points of view. I'm not trying to push my luck here.
Have you seen this
bicycle? Yeah, it's a couple weeks.
The
very nice paper. So for most of the talk, I'll be focusing on theories where the weak coupling perspective doesn't help very much, and the most extreme scenario is a case where you don't even have a proper Lagrangian to spell out what the theory is. And maybe it doesn't exist, or maybe you just don't know what it is. The kind of flip side, the opposite situation, is when you have a single theory that's described by multiple Lagrangians. That can happen in quantum field theory, and that's a phenomenon known as duality. That's not a problem, but that's a feature, but it shows you that the problem is also not fundamental. And so for these reasons, you must find and exploit robust principles and consistency conditions that don't rely on the existence of a Lagrangian, or at least not heavily so. And there are many such principles that we've come up with over the years, and many of them are very old and venerable. Symmetries, of course, are paramount, unitarity. And since this is quantum field theory, all forms of locality that we can exploit. Okay, and all everything that you know goes into most of what we think about these days in quantum field theory, the OPE, crossing symmetry, the bootstrap, all these things are derived from some notion of locality. The other thing that we need to do is to find observables that are actually accessible at strong coupling, and those are also rare and precious. And one general point of view that I want to take in this talk is that there's a kind of give and take between two different approaches to learn more about quantum field theory. One is trying to learn a lot more about one specific example and really study that in depth. The other point of view is to try to kind of understand broad qualitative features that are shared by entire classes of theories. And depending on the situation, you might actually be able to make more progress by sort of giving up on trying to really solve one particular example. So this is just
yes, please. Theories that include gravity or exclude gravity?
No, I'm talking about local quantum field theories with a stress tensor. So in this talk, I will.
Space-time is fixed.
Space-time is fixed, yes. But it could be curved, and that will happen later.
I would
call anything that resembles a path integral a Lagrangian description. So this is basically just a pitch that as quantum field theorists, we should try to explore the entire landscape of consistent field theories and hope to find there new and exotic phenomena and hopefully some unexpected applications. And in the process, learn more about the foundations of the subject, which as I've already kind of alluded to, are still somewhat in flux.
So, is there not really a definition? I thought we had a definition on quantum field theory long ago.
What's your favorite definition?
Well, it's path integrals, but of course, that's old fashioned.
That is the point of view I'll take, very, very heavily take in the colloquium later, and I think it's a wonderful point of view, but we now have actual examples that stretch that point of view, so we'll be flexible about it. I'm not saying that point of view is broken. I'm just saying it doesn't.
It may not capture everything.
Well, there may be an issue of principle, and then there's an issue of practice. Yeah. So of course, this point of view of exploring many different quantum field theories is very second nature to our friends in condensed matter physics. If you talk about fundamental physics, like particle physics, or gravity, you're stuck with one particular theory. But the hope is always.
Well, Sommian approach only describes cutoff fields, and it leaves the you could also find quantum field theory as a bunch of CFDs and flows from there. That's the Wilsonian approach. But the Wilsonian approach, in that sense, describing quantum field theory as extrapolating from well-defined CFDs, extrapolates only to the infrared. And what you're sort of discussing is full space of quantum field theory, which goes towards the UV.
But not including string theory.
No, David, I actually think that I definitely would want to include the ones that you mentioned for sure, the ones that are UV complete.
But I'm just saying the Wilsonian approach is incomplete from the beginning in that it just sets a cutoff.
But it does also give you a precise criterion for when you get to remove the cutoff. So.
Yeah, that's part of it. That tells you nothing about what to do there, and there are infinite numbers as opposed to. The other direction is you have a finite extension from the CFT. Is there an infinite extension in the space that is totally undefined? It certainly contains string theories. You know that. And so,
in fact, there will be a slide more or less. There'll be a slide more or less spelling that out in cartoon form. It's actually the next slide, spelling that out in cartoon form. A lot of what I'm going to talk about later involves RG flows. I don't need to remind you that randomization group flows are an absolute cornerstone of QFT. We've just reviewed that. This is the Wilsonian point of view. They track the dependence of physical observables on the energy scale. And in the perspective that David just reminded us of, there's always a UV cutoff, and you only get to ask about questions below that. So for this talk, I'm always going to assume that we're discussing relativistic theories. So along the flow, we have Poincaré symmetry. But at very low energies, the system has an emergent symmetry, which is scale invariance. And that's what we mean when we say that there's a fixed point in the infrared. And very often, and this is something that Joel made major contributions to, very often this is enhanced to the full conformal group, with at least the global conformal group in D dimensions being SO D, 2. So typically we expect to get a CFT in the infrared, although that's not necessarily the case for all fixed points. And of course, it's interesting to exploit that enhanced symmetry to learn about the fixed point itself and its vicinity. And this whole program of trying to learn about conformal fixed points using just SOD, 2 is known as the conformal bootstrap. And for energies above the cutoff, we don't know what lives there. It doesn't need to be a continuum QFT. It could be a non-field theory. It could be a lattice system. But there are systems in which we are allowed to take the cutoff to infinity. These are the UV complete theories, and in that case, we expect the UV physics to be governed by a new conformal fixed point that governs the whole RG flow from the UV to the IR.
Or something else.
That's what I mean. So I didn't say that it always happens. I think there's a class of theories for which this happens, and these are the ones I would call UV complete quantum field theories. They are UV complete as continuum theories.
So take the case of theories which contain string theory. You would say they can look like field theories of energy.
Yes.
Construct them some kind of field theory. You have to add more and more.
Right. So we believe that not every low energy field theory.
I'm just saying, how do you, in some sense, you're imagining a sharp distinction, a definable distinction between continuum quantum field theory that you haven't defined. You stress you haven't defined and string theory.
Well, first of all, let me emphasize, I'm talking about non-gravitational theory. So embedding and string theory, we need to qualify. But of course, we can take decoupling with us. That's fine. I'm not offering a criterion that allows you to judge from the low energy point of view when a theory is UV complete in the sense that I've defined. I'm just saying this is a situation that can occur. And very often, this is what we have in mind when we say, let's study RG flows between continuum quantum theories. So this is just to make the distinction between the two. Some of the things I'll say will apply to this very general picture. Some of the things will be more specific to this picture. So I think we actually agree. Yes, please.
I'm going to push back on the notion that there's Poincaré symmetry along the flow. I mean, if we start with a lattice, then there's not.
Well, indeed. So here in this picture, we definitely have Poincaré symmetry along the flow. Of course, if I have a lattice cutoff, I have broken that. There will be emergent Poincaré symmetry along with conformal symmetry at low energies, and then you can take into account some of the breaking effects, some higher derivative expansion if you want to.
Sure. Okay, so this is not going to play an important role.
This will not play an important role. No. But certainly, I will assume Poincaré invariant very heavily at various points of view. So here's going to be my pitch for supersymmetry. So I'm going to ride this philosophy of trying to explore quantum field theories in different guises and RG flows between them. And of course, that's generally hard, and so it's very useful to look for simplifying limits. And we know many simplifying limits where QFT becomes more tractable. Topological field theory is perhaps the most well-defined and well-understood simplifying limit, since mathematically rigorous. Conformal field theories were already mentioned. Of course, weakly coupled field theories, and I would include in that large N theories that also a weakly coupled description as an ADS theory. And then integrable theories that are somewhat special. Supersymmetric field theories are an interesting and large class within that kind of set of limits. And just a kind of totally obvious reminder, I mean, this is the supersymmetry algebra in general dimensions. I have a fermionic supercharge, there's a space-time spinner index, and in general there's an internal index that counts the number script n of supersymmetries that I'm talking about. And I'll kind of switch around between different examples throughout the talk. And of course, we know that they play an important role in beyond the standard model of particle physics and cosmology, at least as far as our theoretical brains are wired. And they naturally arise as decoupling limits of string theories as well. And they're somewhat special in this kind of landscape of simplifying limits, in that they display very rich and interesting dynamics, including non-conformal dynamics such as confinement and phenomena such as duality, while remaining somewhat tractable. And the reason for that is that they possess special protected quantities, sometimes called BPS quantities, that can be analyzed exactly. So the poster child for that, for example, is the holomorphic superpotential in 4D n equals to 1 theories. And studying those protected quantities very often gives you a good qualitative picture for the dynamics. And of course, since we already discussed conformal fixed points, if you have a supersymmetric theory and you flow to a conformal fixed point, that symmetry gets further enhanced to the full superconformal symmetry, and then the flow between two fixed points becomes a flow between two superconformal field theories. So what I'm going to do in the rest of the talk is I'm going to sort of showcase a selection of techniques that were recently developed for analyzing supersymmetric field theories. And roughly speaking, there'll be two loose parts. In the first part, I'll discuss symmetry algebras and their representations, or multiplets. In the second part, I'll discuss current algebra, and I'll discuss what I mean by that. Roughly speaking, I mean multiplets of conserved currents. And in the last part, I will couple those conserved currents to suitable background fields, including curved background metric, non-dynamical. And if these sound like techniques that have been around for a while and that you've already heard about a long time ago, that's indeed true, and that's not surprising. These are old and venerable quantum field theory techniques. The main mileage we're going to get is by souping them up with the full power that supersymmetry affords us, sort of combining supersymmetry with these more conventional and traditional techniques that will give us additional mileage. And in particular, I'll give some examples of how these techniques lead to general constraints on RG flows in different dimensions, and restrictions on the properties of bound states and solitons in supersymmetric gauge theories and more exotic theories, and the construction of new exactly computable observables that you can define by placing the field theory on a curved manifold. Okay. So we already mentioned superconformal theories. There's a huge algebra, symmetry algebra, the superconformal algebra. And in addition to the Poincaré Q superchargers, you also have the superconformal S superchargers, and they're important commutators. For example, the one between Q and S that includes the dilatation generator, the Lorentz generators, and also typically an internal R symmetry generator that rotates the I and J indices of the superchargers. And as always, it's possible to analyze interesting supersymmetric RG flows that break conformal invariance by studying small deformations around a superconformal fixed point. So of course, this is the canonical division of these deformations into the relevant, irrelevant, and marginal. And here I have the cartoon picture to remind you of that. So we start with this CFT, SCFT, and then we can have an irrelevant operator along which you flow into the fixed point, or a relevant operator that takes you out of the fixed point. And in special situations, you also have exactly marginal operators that interpolate continuously between a family of superconformal theories, like, for example, the family of four-dimensional n equals to 4 Yang-Mills theories labeled by the gauge coupling. Okay, and a basic truism is that all local operators in these theories must reside in unitary multiplets of the superconformal algebra, and you would think that that's a totally straightforward problem to enumerate all of these multiplets, but they're actually very rich and complicated because they have an intricate null state structure. And one technical tool that we recently developed in some detail was a very general algorithm for correctly removing all of these null states and actually completely automatizing the generation of superconformal multiplets in all dimensions. And that's a very useful tool that will come into play various times. So I'm going to use that to classify deformations, classify conserved currents, and I'll mention some implications for supergravity theories and anti-de Sitter space as well. So, of course, unsurprisingly, all theories have lots of irrelevant operators. That's what our intuition tells us. And some have relevant or marginal ones. And all of these different operators are useful. And this classification into multiplets is a very good way of thinking about them. Roughly speaking, it gives you some type of on-shell superspace for writing supersymmetric Lagrangians, even when a standard superspace formalism is not available. And if you've tried writing supersymmetric Lagrangians and theories with extended supersymmetry, then you know why that's useful. And you can prove all sorts of neat things about different theories using this classification. And one surprising fact that you can prove that I will come back to later in the talk is that 6D superconformal field theories do not admit any relevant or marginal operator deformations that preserve supersymmetry. So later I'll comment a little bit more about why we should think about quantum field theory in more than six dimensions in the first place. But if you believe that that's an interesting thing to do, then this is an amusing result. It tells you that in the language of the renormalization group, there's no need to tune any parameters to flow into the fixed point. And so in the language of statistical mechanics, it's kind of a self-organized critical point that just naturally attracts. Of course, here, supersymmetry plays an important role in protecting that property. And it's a non-trivial result because, as I'll explain in more detail later, none of the interacting 6D CFTs that we know have a Lagrangian. So we learn something completely general about them without even having to lift a finger or worry about the fact that we didn't have a Lagrangian. Of course, I should emphasize, and this will again play a role a bit later.
A Lagrangian itself would be a marginal operator.
Well, not really.
If
the Lagrangian is itself a nice marginal operator in the theory, that means you have a marginal coupling, like in n equals to 4. And you certainly don't always have a marginal coupling.
But does that mean that the theory, you're saying that if these theories had a Lagrangian, the coupling would have to be irrelevant?
A good toy model for these theories, the simplest 6D theories are just theories of free chiral tensor multiplets,
yeah,
which are excellent analogs of 2D chiral bosons. So standard 2D boson has a marginal parameter, the radius, and the Lagrangian is the marginal operator.
Right.
But if you do the chiral projection, that marginal operator disappears and the radius is quantized and so forth. So roughly that's what happens in the free tensor multiplet in six dimensions. So even at the level of the free theory, you don't have a marginal parameter.
Sorry, in that case, in your three-dimensional example, after the chiral projection, do you have a Lagrangian description? Is Lagrangian an operator in the naive sense?
Well, you don't have a... there's a lot of debate in the literature about whether you have a Lagrangian for these theories. The short answer is yes.
Okay.
For example,
short answer is what?
The short answer is yes. It's easy to write a Lagrangian. I think you worked on this also. the only thing is that the simplest Lagrangians to write down are not manifestly Lorentz invariant. They are Lorentz invariant, just not manifestly. So a nice Lagrangian for the chiral boson in 2D is they have a scalar field phi, and then you write an action dx phi, dt phi, plus dx phi squared. So that's a chiral boson in two dimensions. So for example, this is what you get for the edge modes and the quantum Hall effect. And so
somehow this is still not a marginal operator in this sense.
No, it's I think it's just because it vanishes on shell.
Oh, okay, I see. Yeah. All right. Thanks.
That's an easy way in which the Lagrangian can fail to be a marginal operator.
Yes.
Okay, so one thing that I'm just going to quickly remind you of, because it'll appear at various points in the talk, is that many, many supersymmetric field theories and superconformal theories have moduli spaces of vacua, where some scalar field phi gets a VEV, and that can break conformal symmetry as well, but it does so spontaneously rather than explicitly, and then you can have a non-trivial RG flow interpolating between the CFT at the origin and the CFT on the moduli space. And that can happen even in these 6D theories that don't have marginal operator deformations or relevant operator deformations. Okay, so I said a few words about representation theory of the superconformal algebra. So in general, you know, if I call script A some symmetry algebra that I might be discussing, so far I've only discussed the representations of the algebra itself. And so far we discussed the superconformal case. But local quantum field theory has a lot more structure than just the global symmetry algebra. In particular, we expect that the generators, script Q of the symmetry algebra should arise from local currents, J, which are local operators, J of X. Now, this might seem totally obvious, because if you have a Lagrangian and the symmetry you're discussing is a symmetry of the Lagrangian, this is just Noether's theorem. More generally, it's an assumption. We don't actually have a general theorem in quantum field theory that says that all continuous symmetries are generated by local currents. And in fact, there are very simple but slightly sick examples of theories that violate this. I'd be happy to tell you all about that. Now, the currents themselves must be well-defined local operators. Otherwise, we shouldn't discuss them. And therefore, they themselves should reside in some multiplet of the symmetry algebra. So let me call that multiplet script J. Script J is a multiplet of operators that is in a representation of the symmetry algebra. So this is the structure. Here's the multiplet. The currents sit in the multiplet. They're local operators. When you integrate them over space, you get the charges. And finally, the charges themselves have to act on the multiplet to correctly generate the whole structure. So I will use the words current algebra to refer to this structure, okay? To refer to the action of the global charges Q on the currents or on the other operators in the current multiplet, you know, commutators like this, integrating a relation such as the commutator of Q with the current is constrained by the fact that you need to recover the symmetry algebra. So this whole structure is actually pretty constraining, and we'll get quite a bit of mileage out of it.
But you're not going to JJ.
I'm not going to JJ. That's even harder. That gives you even more mileage. You can do that in two dimensions, of course, with great success, but in higher dimensions, it gets pretty hard. The constraints that follow from this current algebra structure are much, much stronger than the ones that just follow from the representation theory of the symmetry algebra. And the 2D case is a little bit special, and we typically kind of think the two are equivalent there, roughly speaking, because in 2D, you can think of current algebra itself as an enhanced global symmetry algebra, like a Kac-Moody algebra. But that's very special to 2D. For instance, one of the constraints that current algebra can imply is that some allowed symmetry representations, some allowed representations of the algebra, might actually be forbidden by the existence of local currents. So there's a classic example of this that you are all familiar with, which is the Weinberg-Witten theorem, for simplicity, say, in four dimensions. So in that case, the symmetry algebra is just the Poincaré symmetry, and the corresponding current is just the stress tensor. And as representations of the Poincaré symmetry, of course, we know that there are massless particles of arbitrary half-integral helicity H. But if you examine the matrix element of the stress tensor between such massless particle states, then there's a selection rule that says that that matrix element is only non-zero if the helicity is bounded by 1 in absolute value. That comes from the fact that you can choose a configuration in which these particles kind of collide head-on. Therefore, the change in angular momentum through this matrix element is 2h, and the stress tensor only has spin 2. Now, we know this matrix element has to be non-zero, because if you take the forward limit where the momentum transfer through the stress tensor goes to 0, you actually measure the energy of the massless particle. Roughly speaking, you're kind of scattering a soft virtual graviton off of the particle. So it has to be non-zero and finite, and therefore the bound follows. So we have cut down the number of allowed representations by a lot, and this is worth keeping in mind for later. For now, I'm going to make a brief detour and give some sort of non-perturbative version of the Weinberg-Witten theorem in supersymmetric theories that will kind of validate and reorganize some standard lore. So the standard lore is that if we look at the massless single particle representations of just Poincaré supersymmetry, then if we have too much supersymmetry, we violate the Weinberg-Witten bound. Okay? Just because if you act with more and more Qs, you raise the helicity of the massless particles. So if you want to stay within the regime of, you know, within the realm of field theory, you should stop when you hit helicity 1. And that bounds the allowed number of supercharges by 16. So if you have more than 16 supercharges, you get particles of helicity bigger than 1. So this leads to the standard lore that indeed quantum field theory only makes sense for 16 or less supercharges. But this lore is based on free particle reasoning, okay? So we would like to understand whether this lore is still correct if we live in the world of strongly coupled interacting superconformal fixed points. So let me very briefly remind you what the different superconformal algebras are. They are very restricted algebraically, and they were completely classified long ago by Werner Naum. And in more than two space-time dimensions, this is the whole list. I'm going from 3, 4, 5, 6 dimensions, and there's nothing above 6 dimensions for algebraic reasons. So these are all of them. And in 5 dimensions, there's a unique superconformal algebra. It's kind of an exceptional algebra. But in all other cases, there's an infinite family of algebras parameterized by n, which labels the amount of supersymmetry. So there is plenty of room for symmetry algebras and in principle theories with n much, much bigger than 16 supercharges. However, the claim is that most of these superconformal algebras are not consistent with current algebra. Okay? And the current algebra we need to do now involves the stress tensor and the supersymmetry current and the R-symmetry current. Right? The symmetry we're discussing is the superconformal symmetry, and these are the currents that give rise to that. Okay? And very roughly speaking, they must transform into each other under supersymmetry in this general pattern. So Q acts on the R-symmetry current to get the supersymmetry current, and Q acts on the supersymmetry current to get the stress tensor. And roughly speaking, because Q commutes with the momentum, Q acting on the stress tensor should be a total derivative. And this whole structure must fit into a unitary representation of the superconformal algebra. And we have made a complete list of those. Right? We have a machine that spits out all the allowed multiplets. So now we can go and check. And the claim is that, first of all, such a structure doesn't exist when you have more than 16 supercharges and you're in 4D or in 6D. So this validates the standard lore there, but in a completely general and non-perturbative way. And it turns out that there's a nice little wrinkle in 3 dimensions. In 3 dimensions, it turns out that a candidate stress tensor multiplet actually exists for any amount of supersymmetry. But if you look at it in detail, you find that if you have more than 9 supercharges in 3 dimensions, which corresponds to having in total more than 16 individual supercharges, then T not only contains these currents that we already know we needed to have, but it also contains higher spin currents. And then there are very general arguments, both old and recent, that tell you that the theory should be a free field theory. And indeed, it's completely trivial to write down free field theories with any amount of supersymmetry in 3 dimensions. In fact, it's basically just a generalized free hypermultiplet with lots of indices. And the reason the standard lore fails here is completely elementary. The lore is based on helicity and increasing the helicity as you act with the supercharges. But of course, the little group is discrete in 3 dimensions. There's no notion of helicity for massless particles. And there's a simple translation of all of these statements into kind of dual ADS supergravity language, which says that in 5 and 7 dimensions, you cannot have ADS, supersymmetric ADS vacua with more than 16 supercharges. But in ADS 4, you can have higher spin supergravities for any amount of supersymmetry. And I'm not sure if these have been looked at, but they should presumably be easy to construct. Okay, so we talked a lot about conformal theories, and they're a good starting point for understanding non-conformal theories. So let's see how much we can say about non-conformal theories. The attitude that I'm going to take now is that conformal theories are harder because the symmetry algebra is smaller, but current algebra is still very useful. We already saw that in the Weinberg-Witten case, which didn't require conformal symmetry. And I'm going to illustrate that with kind of one example. So now I would like to discuss in a little bit of detail. So the setting is going to be 4-dimensional theories with extended n equals to 2 supersymmetry. There's too much supersymmetry to be of phenomenological interest, but it's a hugely rich and successful kind of landscape of toy models for realistic field theories like QCD. There's confinement and bound states and all sorts of other good things. And because of the extended supersymmetry, there's an enormous wealth of mathematical structure that actually leads to very powerful ways of computing various protected BPS quantities. And the mathematics associated with these theories is also intrinsically interesting. For example, they have rich applications to four manifold topology. So let me briefly remind you, this is the centrally extended supersymmetry algebra in 4D. N equals to 2, this is the standard commutator Q with Q bar gives the momentum. And this is the commutator of Q with Q, which includes a complex central charge Z. Here I have two supercharges. The I is a doublet index, and that doublet index is rotated by an SU2R symmetry. And the central charge is just a Lorentz scalar, so it's carried by point particles. And when the mass of these point particles is in some units equal to the absolute value of Z, then they are annihilated by half of the supercharges, their BPS. And that's, roughly speaking, what makes it possible to analyze them both at weak and at strong coupling. So this is an enormously rich subject that I won't do justice to. Let me just give you the basic cartoon physics points. So most of the, or all the interesting n equals to 2 theories that we know about have moduli spaces of vacua, and at very low energies, the dynamics there just looks like free abelian gauge theory. And the BPS particles in that description are very heavy, electrically and magnetically charged, massive dions. And you can analyze them both at weak and at strong coupling. At weak coupling, they look like, they can look like monopole solitons, but in general, they look like horrendously complicated multi-monopole bound states that, you know, get, you know, bound together by and in kind of ridiculously intricate ways and make kind of big galaxies of monopoles and dions, and they're only kind of stable because of supersymmetry. At strong coupling, the picture changes dramatically very often. For example, they can even look like fundamental particles, and they're famous examples where they even become massless. So they're a little bit like pions in QCD from that point of view. And they're great toy models for bound states in quantum field theory, which is a subject that is kind of notoriously difficult. So if you use current algebra, you actually can deduce a rather surprising result. Namely, you can deduce that all the BPS particles in n equals to 2 theories are completely neutral under the SU2R symmetry. And this is a pretty dramatic and surprising result about bound states in these theories, because you know there's lots of elementary degrees of freedom that are charged in the SU2R symmetry. And roughly speaking, you would expect that at strong coupling, anything goes, and you could get lots of bound states which carry very large R charges. But in fact, you find that modulo some kind of center of mass that you can always factorize out, the bound states are SU2R neutral. So just by analogy, this is roughly as dramatic as claiming falsely that all the mesons and baryons in QCD were isospin neutral. This is, of course, not true in QCD, but this is roughly what this statement is analogous to. And it has interesting physical and mathematical consequences for these theories. For instance, let me make one comment about how you prove this. I'm not going to go through the proof in detail. It's a little bit technical, but very, very intuitively, the proof uses Ward identities of the n equals to 2 stress tensor multiplet. That's where the current algebra aspect comes in. And roughly speaking, what you can show using those commutators is that the forward matrix element of the R current sandwiched in between the BPS states has to vanish. So this is exactly the same matrix element that we looked at in the Weinberg-Witten case. In the forward limit, it tries to measure the charge of the object that you're sandwiching it in between. Here we're sandwiching the R current, and we just find that in the forward limit, we get zero. There are a few extra bells and whistles having to do with CPT and so forth, but let me not get into that. So let me say two kind of consequences of this result. From a physics point of view, it's interesting because the fact that all of these quantum numbers vanish mean that various supersymmetric protected indices that count the degeneracies of these particles up to sign, up to fermion minus sign, are actually such that the minus signs are all pluses. Okay, so a protected index that was formerly potentially positive or negative is now counting the physical degeneracy, and that's something that's physically interesting. And for example, in the context of black hole microstate counting, that's an extremely useful property, because then you can translate from a Suzy index to an actual entropy. Here we're.
There's no proof that only stable particles are you could have
absolutely
non-BPS stable particles with our charge.
Yes, I'm not saying anything about those. It uses very heavily the fact that these are BPS particles. There's a certain conventional wisdom that these are unlikely, but of course we know some examples of such things, like in string theory.
Unlikely,
that if you have a sort of generic, strongly interacting theory, you would kind of more or less expect that non-protected things are not stable, unless, but we do know counterexamples. So. Let me make one small mathematical comment. As I said, you know, these theories have very interesting and rich connections with you know, serious areas of you know, geometry, topology, and so forth. This result has an interesting consequence for the cohomology of monopole moduli spaces, which is something that the geometers are interested in. Roughly speaking, when you describe these bound states semi-classically, what you do is you start with monopole moduli space and then you quantize it. In practical terms, you compute its cohomology. And the fact that all the states, all the normalizable states, are neutral under SU2R is some very strong vanishing theorem on that cohomology. So in fact, this is a fact that I'm told is very surprising to geometers. I don't know if they agree with that.
You say it relies very heavily on these being BPS particles. As far as you know, if you had an article that was close to being BPS, could it have arbitrarily large charge?
Okay, that's very interesting.
Here?
I don't know the answer to that question, but it's very interesting to think about it. You might imagine that you can prove something like a bound.
Yeah.
That says that if you're very close to being BPS, then the R charge can't be too huge. Right. But I have no evidence for or against. Yeah, indeed. I think Ashok Sen wanted to understand whether this is true, but I. Mm-hmm. Part of the problem is you have no examples.
The R charge can't be. What can't be?
So this statement says that if the particle is exactly BPS, then the R charge is exactly zero. You might wonder if you deform.
But the R symmetry is issue too, right?
Yeah, but you could still imagine that there's a bound.
You mean it can't be spin 1/2 or?
You know, for
it's
example,
discrete, it's not continuous.
Yeah, but for example, when, I don't know, maybe if you're sufficiently close to, right, so again, since it's quantized, you might imagine that if you're arbitrarily close to being BPS, then by some type of continuity, it still has to be R charge zero, and then maybe if you have to move a kind of a finite distance away from being BPS before it can jump, something like that.
That was the question. I mean, there are many things that are discontinuous about BPS things, there's representations that don't have.
But this is even worse. These are non-BPS things. Anything goes. So, yeah. No, it's a good question. The natural place to try to study would be a weak coupling, but that weak coupling, these things are horrendously hard to compute because they're these complicated multi-monopole configurations. So we don't have a lot of data. Okay.
Just remind me, the SU2 symmetry you're talking about, the R symmetry, is that something that enters into the BPS bound, or is it an independent bound?
So it does not enter the BPS bound at the level of the algebra. That's why the BPS bound doesn't tell you anything a priori about the R-symmetric quantum numbers, and that's why proving a vanishing theorem is an additional thing that you get from local currents. Part three, we have already learned things by looking at symmetries, looking at currents, and the sort of most sophisticated thing you can do with currents in quantum field theory in some sense is coupling them to classical sources and background fields. And this is, again, totally standard. If you have a U1 flavor current, you can couple it to a background gauge field. If you have, every quantum field theory has a stress tensor, so you can always couple it to a background metric. Here I've written kind of the linearized deformations, but the whole point is that once you have these couplings, you can non-linearly complete them, and you can put the theory on an arbitrary curved background and turn on arbitrary U1 bundles and so forth. And studying the theories in such backgrounds that are kind of in some sense very far away from flat space is very fruitful. For example, you can look at the partition function in such backgrounds, many other observables, and it can capture aspects of the theory that are very difficult to see from the point of view of flat space. So the poster child of this is modular invariance in two dimensions, where by looking at the partition function on a torus, you can learn about non-trivial constraints on the operator spectrum in flat space. And this is, in some sense, the most interesting situation. If you put the theory in a funny space, and then you learn something about flat space. Of course, you can also just put it on a weird, funny space, and then you learn what it does on that funny space, but that's less intrinsically interesting. I'm going to say a few words about how to study supersymmetry in curved space, and you know, there are experts in the audience, including Brian, so I apologize for not being very thorough in my referencing here. And you know, in some sense, this is a subject that is both very old and very new. Some examples of supersymmetric field theories in curved space have been known since the 80s. There's the Witten index and the topological twist in particular. But in the last 10 years or so, there's been a kind of a rejuvenation of the subject with many, many cool results, but sort of a consistent formal framework for how to do this from first principles was put forth by these authors. And the main idea is very simple, namely just that the background metric, the non-dynamical background metric on the manifold that you would like to put the theory on must itself reside in a supersymmetry multiplet, and in particular, an off-shell supergravity multiplet. So let me
really
say.
Are there no restrictions on GNU and globally hyperbolic? Can you have closed timeline curves?
Well, it depends a little bit on the situation. So for example, you could study Euclidean theories, and then G is just a Riemannian metric. If you would like to study unitary theories in Lorentzian signature, you would, you know, have additional selection criteria like the ones you mentioned. I mean, the idea is to have a healthy quantum field theory on this background. So definitely I would like.
In Euclidean space.
Or Lorentzian space.
Oh, I see. This is.
In Euclidean space, there are essentially no restrictions. As long as G is a Riemannian metric, I can do it. But in Lorentzian signature, there are. OK. So one way to think about this, which is quite intuitive and kind of builds on this current perspective that I've been taking, is that we start with a stress tensor, and that itself in flat space sits in a multiplet of supersymmetry, has some super partners, which could be either bosons or fermions. And then correspondingly, the background metric G, which couples to T, also sits in some multiplet, and it has some bosonic and fermionic super partners. And everything couples naturally to its friend. You know, the metric couples to T, and the bosons coupled to bosons, the fermions coupled to fermions. And of course, any multiplet containing a metric must be a supergravity multiplet. That's almost a tautology. But in particular, because the metric here is not dynamical, it doesn't satisfy any equations of motion. So it has to be an off-shell multiplet. That's point one. And for most standard applications where we would like to write a nice standard Lagrangian for the theory on the space, we would like the Lagrangian to be bosonic, so we turn off all the fermionic sources. There are funny and interesting and curious examples where you might consider relaxing that requirement, but let me not discuss them here. So we activate the metric and all the bosonic background fields that we can. And of course, setting the fermions to zero typically breaks supersymmetry. And so what happens is that, you know, in the special situation when this vanishing condition is stable under the action of supersymmetry, that's the situation in which you actually have a global supercharge Q that exists on the manifold. And among other conditions, this always contains some type of killing spinner-like equation for the spinner zeta that parametrizes the supercharge Q. And it looks something like this, and it's killing spinner-like because it could also depend in some interesting way on all the bosonic background fields in the theory. So this equation and its friends is the starting point for a systematic program to explore all possible backgrounds for supersymmetric field theories. And you know, from a technical point of view, analyzing the physics and first of all, finding these backgrounds and then analyzing the physics of the theory in this background has a flavor that's somewhat similar to analyzing string compactifications or supergravity compactifications. And let me just say for you know the experts, this is obvious, but in typical situations, if you refuse to turn on all this extra junk and just want to turn on the metric, then the metric needs to be very special, and you only preserve supersymmetry if you have a covariantly constant spinner. And the good news is that once you've found a solution to these equations, almost all the rest of the machinery follows from supergravity. You know, the Lagrangians on the space, the transformation laws for the fields. So you can borrow all of those results to the extent that they have been worked out.
Even if you do turn on the other fields, isn't there still a high, isn't the set of backgrounds in which you find these charges, how do you constrain?
Yes. You have to solve these killing spinner equations.
Yes.
But the backgrounds are constrained, but they're much, much richer than if you didn't turn on the other stuff. Okay, so I don't have time to do justice to this field, and I will shamelessly emphasize my own work. Let me mention a few select applications of this machine. So for example, if you start with 4D theories with minimal supersymmetry, n equals to 1, and the theory has an R symmetry, then you can use this whole construction to place that theory on an arbitrary complex surface, which in particular need not be a Kähler manifold. And then when you compute the partition function on that surface, you get an object that depends holomorphically on the complex structure moduli and nothing else. So roughly speaking, you can think of this as, from a mathematical point of view, kind of a holomorphic analog of Donaldson theory.
Wait, is there a holomorphic anomaly or not?
Well, you'd have to tell me what you mean by a holomorphic anomaly in this context.
Well, it's like the T-bar equations or something like that.
T star?
Yeah.
I don't think so. Not in this case. I don't know of any example where you can explicitly compute and find an anomaly. But to be fair, the explicit computations have also been limited to somewhat special examples. So that's an interesting question. So one of the examples that's been beaten to death is when you take this complex surface to have the topology of S3 times S1, that's what's called a Hopf surface. And Hopf surfaces have two complex structure parameters, sometimes called P and Q. And then the partition function depends holomorphically on P and Q. And it turns out that that partition function defines an index that counts BPS operators, roughly speaking, by the usual state operator intuition that states on S3 correspond to local operators, and then the S1 counts them. And this index can be tracked along RG flows because of supersymmetry. And for that reason, it can also be matched across non-trivial dualities. So it's a very powerful and flexible object that has given us a lot of room to play with interesting RG flows. And if you KK reduce on the S1 to get a theory in three dimensions, what you get with, first of all, is a theory in 3D with n equals to 2 supersymmetry. This is a subject that was pioneered by Brian and his collaborators. And if we reduce the most general Hopf surface on S1, what we get is a squashed 3-sphere with one complex squashing parameter, B. So one of the complex structure moduli drops out if we do the reduction. And the three-dimensional partition function is also an interesting function of this squashing parameter. And it turns out to encode various physically relevant quantities. For example, one way of interpreting it is as encoding entanglement Rényi entropies across a disk in flat space, which you can compute exactly. And another way of interpreting the answer is as computing certain stress tensor correlation functions of the theory. If you expand in powers of B, if you think of B, roughly speaking, as a metric fluctuation, and you expand in powers of B, you learn about 1, 2, 3, et cetera, point functions of the stress tensor. So these are not just kind of geometric and mathematical objects. The whole philosophy is to extract from them some useful lesson about the field theory in flat space. And more recently, things that we've been looking at are indices in theories with extended supersymmetry. These are interesting because unlike in n equals to 1 theories, where essentially the index is only sensitive to the massless degrees of freedom at low energies, in theories with extended supersymmetry, the index is also sensitive to some massive degrees of freedom, in particular the BPS ones. One other interesting spin-off that these n equals to 2 indices have led to is some type of new modularity relations in four-dimensional theories. So put that in quotes and let me say what I mean. What I mean by modularity relations are statements that relate, sums over some class of objects to sums over a different class of objects. So for example, in two dimensions, the situation is very special because on a torus, you do two sums, one over the A cycle and one over the B cycle. They're different sums, but they both count local operators. So that's a very special situation where local operators get related to themselves. In four dimensions, what you can do is you can slice S3 times S1 in two different ways. If you slice it along, if you cut off the S1, then the states on S3 are local operators. But it turns out that if you slice it in a different way, roughly speaking, cut across the equatorial 2-sphere of the S3, you can use supersymmetry to kind of unwrap it and make line operators. So I'm not going to explain that in detail, but this modularity relation relates a sum over local operators to a sum over line operators. And so it's a kind of interesting local, non-local analog of modular invariance in four dimensions. And finding useful analogs of modular invariance in higher dimensions has been a kind of important goal of higher dimensional quantum field theory. The emphasis here is on useful because, of course, there are many straightforward analogs of modular invariance in higher dimensions, but it's only useful if you have a dual interpretation for what you're counting. Oh, was there a question? And I should say that all of these quantities and many, many more can be computed exactly using the technique of supersymmetric localization, which has been a hugely productive endeavor. But unfortunately, it does require the existence of a path integral formulation and the Lagrangian. OK. So in the last 10 minutes or so, I'm going to use all the ideas of the talk, all the tools that I've described, and in particular coupling currents to background fields, to say a few words about anomalies of 6D superconformal field theories. Okay? Coupling currents to background fields is especially useful to study anomalies in those currents. It's kind of the only sensible way to make the anomalies visible and exploit all of their properties. This has been known for a long time. But again, supersymmetry will give us extra mileage. So at this point, let me dispense a few words about interacting conformal field theories in more than four dimensions. Conventional quantum field theory wisdom is that such theories should not exist. And the argument is that if you try to follow the Wilsonian picture and introduce a cutoff and then write a Lagrangian with interactions, and you try to take the cutoff to infinity, all the interactions flow away, and you just end up with a free theory. But we've known for more than 20 years now that decoupling limits of string theory give rise to many interesting interacting supersymmetric examples of such theories in 5 and 6 dimensions. Maybe the poster child for that is the 6D 2.0 theory, or I should say the family of 6D 2.0 theories. One subfamily of those are the ones that you get by decoupling gravity on a stack of parallel M5 brains in M theory. And by now, there are many, many 6D examples, some of them also known for a long time, and many, many more constructed recently, including by work that Dave has done with his collaborators. And there are also many examples in 5D, although I won't focus on those so much. And none of these theories has a known Lagrangian description. That could change tomorrow if somebody smart writes a Lagrangian, but there's a certain debate about whether we expect that to be true or possible. But in some sense, it's not so interesting. We have these theories. They're a bit like black boxes. You can get at them from string theory, but it's very hard because you have to take the decoupling limit, and there's a lot of stuff that you want to kind of get rid of to get to the actual field theory. So they're an interesting challenge in quantum field theory. Saying anything useful about these theories just using quantum field theory is kind of a frontier in this subject. So all 6D10 theories, superconformal theories, have various kinds of anomalies, in particular two different classes of anomalies. They have global symmetries, namely an SU2R symmetry, just like 4D n equals to 2 theories. And the R symmetry can have a Tuft anomalies, and there can also be a Tuft anomalies for gravity, so diffeomorphism anomalies. So I'm encoding the R symmetry by R and the gravity anomalies by T for tangent bundle. And there's an anomaly 8-form polynomial that encodes all of these anomalies, including the mixed ones. So there are 4 coefficients here, alpha, beta, gamma, and delta. These are pure numbers. This is an pure R symmetry anomaly. This is a mixed R symmetry gravity anomaly. And there are 2 independent gravity anomalies in 6 dimensions. And since we're discussing conformal theories in even dimensions, there are also Weyl anomalies, conformal anomalies, which show up when you look at the trace of the stress tensor in the presence of a background metric. And then that trace can be expanded in some curvature invariance. And it turns out that there's always a single curvature invariant proportional to the Euler density in D dimensions, which is usually called the A-type anomaly. And then there are many other Weyl invariant curvature combinations that can typically appear on the right-hand side. The number rapidly grows as a function of space-time dimension, and their coefficients are known as the C-type Weyl anomalies. There's a bit of a notational mess here that has persisted just because what we usually call A in higher dimensions actually reduces to what we usually call C in two dimensions, and it's the Virasoro C, because in two dimensions the Euler density is proportional to the Ricci scalar, and there are no violent variants. Okay, so the Itauf anomaly is encoded by the 8-form polynomial, and the Weyl anomaly is encoded by the one-point function of the stress tensor in a metric background. Both depend on the metric background field, of course, and also the R-symmetry background gauge field. And as we've already learned in other examples, both of these background fields sit in a single supergravity multiplet. So it's very natural to suspect that the anomalies might be related as well by supersymmetry. And this is indeed the case. It's called a multiplet of anomalies. There are other examples of such multiplets of anomalies in other dimensions that we know about, have known about for quite a while. And in six dimensions, it's no different. For example, there's a nice simple formula that allows you to compute the A anomaly, the A-type Weyl anomaly, as this linear combination of Itauf anomalies. And why is this useful? It's very useful because when you build 60 CFTs by starting from constructions in string theory and taking decoupling limits and so forth, it's very difficult to access the conformal anomalies directly because they're a delicate property of the conformal fixed point. But the Weyl anomalies are much more robust. So, for example, if you have a brain construction, you can very often infer what the Weyl anomalies are just by looking at the inflow of the anomaly onto the brain and looking at various Simons terms in the bulk and so forth. So these are much easier to calculate, and they have been calculated for zillions of examples. And now we even have a pretty good understanding of how to get them directly from field theory. And then using this formula, you can compute the A anomaly. Why do you care about the A anomaly? That'll have to wait for the next slide. Let me make one comment about how you might prove such a relation. You might try to prove such a relation by supersymmetrizing all the various curvature polynomials that appear in the anomaly formulas. So there, you know, there's an Euler class in this stress tensor, and there are various characteristic classes in the 8-form polynomial. The problem is that these are cubic curvature invariants, and supersymmetrizing cubic supergravity curvature invariants is a horrendous nightmare, and I'm not sure that it's ever been done in any dimension. So the state of the art is kind of quadratic invariants. Good. Now, we'll come back to the A anomaly in just a second. But let me say something about what kind of RG flows we could potentially study in the context of these 60 theories. So there was a theorem in the very beginning of the talk that said that these theories didn't have any relevant deformations, but I also emphasized that they have moduli spaces. And so we can deform the theory onto the moduli space where conformal symmetry is broken spontaneously. That's a very universal thing to do. And the Goldstone theorem tells you that you necessarily have a Nambu-Goldstone boson for the spontaneously broken symmetry. That's the dilaton. It's a massless, weakly interacting scalar particle, phi. And like any other Goldstone boson, like the pion and so forth, there's a nice well-defined low-energy effective action for it. It's free at leading order, and there's a leading four-derivative interaction, some coefficient b, dimensionless coefficient b, and then there's an interesting six-derivative interaction. And right now, you should just think of these coefficients b and delta a as being just some random coefficients. We'll say something about them in just a second. And I've put powers of the VEV in the denominator here to make up for the scaling dimensions. So in a general non-supersymmetric setting, we wouldn't have anything useful to say about B. We can actually show that B has to be positive, but we would have no sensible physics interpretation for it. It turns out that in supersymmetric theories, by using this whole machinery of coupling to supergravity background field and working a little bit, you can show that B is actually determined by the Itauf anomalies for the global symmetries. The reason is that supersymmetrizing B leads to a bunch of Green-Schwarz-like terms that are needed for anomaly matching, and the coefficients alpha, beta, gamma, and so forth appear naturally in those terms. So in supersymmetric theories, we can say something useful about B. And the good news is that because this is a four-derivative operator, it actually only requires supersymmetrizing a quadratic curvature invariant, which is much easier and has thankfully been worked out by some supergravity experts. Now, the six-derivative term, this one, is not quite what I've written here. You should think of this expression as being a little bit schematic. It's actually quite a bit more complicated than that. What it actually is a Wesumino term for the conformal symmetry. That means that when you act on it with a special conformal boost, it's not invariant, it actually shifts by a total derivative, much like the Wesomino term in pion physics. And its role in life is to absorb the mismatch in the A-type Weyl anomaly between the original UV CFT and the infrared CFT. So that's why its coefficient was called delta A. It's precisely the difference in the UV and IR A anomalies. Just like the coefficient NC, the number of colors appears in the 4D Wesomino Witten term. And in general, delta A and B have no known relation or relationship. But in supersymmetric theories, it actually turns out that they are related. Supersymmetry implies a universal quadratic relationship between the two. So delta A, which is the coefficient of a sixth derivative term, actually turns out to be proportional to the square of B, the coefficient of a four derivative term. And therefore, it's manifestly positive, manifestly and trivially positive. Okay? And one way to prove this is to use this kind of on-shell superspace that I briefly alluded to at the beginning of the talk to supersymmetrize the higher derivative terms in this dilaton action. And what this shows is that the A-type Weyl anomaly decreases under renormalization group flow. The UV anomaly is bigger than the IR anomaly, at least under all supersymmetric RG flows onto the tensor branch. And it turns out that looking at this more carefully, it also establishes the formula I quoted earlier that expresses A in terms of the Itoft anomalies. So as I'm sure many, many of you know, John Hardy conjectured a long time ago that the A-type Weyl anomaly should always satisfy this relationship for all unitary RG flows in even dimensions, and this is known as the A theorem. It's known as the A theorem even in situations in which it hasn't been proven. And it's believed to be a deep statement about quantum field theory because it makes quantitative and precise the intuitive notion that RG flows get rid of effective degrees of freedom. The number of effective degrees of freedom decreases as you flow from short to long distances. And A is a quantitative measure of that. Now, in 2D, this fact has been known for almost 30 years. It was proven by Samolodchikov. And in 4D, it was proven much more recently by Komorgotsky and Schwimmer. As of now, there's no general proof for six dimensions, essentially because in four dimensions, the relevant term was the four derivative term that here was called B. But here in six dimensions, it's the sixth derivative term that is subleading in the derivative expansion, so it's much harder to access. And it's an important open problem, I think, to find a general proof. But the good news is that because of this fun fact that followed from supersymmetry, we have a completely straightforward and proof of the A theorem for a very large class of supersymmetric RG flows. So I don't know if I can take two more minutes to say a few more words about the M2 brain, the M5 brain anomaly. But, if there's interest, I would like to. Because this is something that is one of the more mysterious aspects of 6D field theories that keeps kind of coming up as a goal to measure our understanding, so to speak. So using our formula, we can actually compute exactly the A-type anomaly for two zero theories living on a stack of n parallel M5 brains. And it's given by some cubic expression and a linear piece, a linear correction. And this is in units in which a single M5 brain contributes one. The leading piece has been known for a long time. It's a famous early prediction of ADS-CFT in holography. The subleading piece is new, that we added that. And the fact that the leading piece goes like n cubed is often referred to as mysterious or puzzling because unlike in four dimensions, the analogy with four dimensions is such that the four-dimensional case has a very simple intuitive explanation associated to it. The 4D, the analog 4D theory that this is compared to is 4D n equals to 4 Suzy-Yang-Mills, let's say with UN gauge group, where the A anomaly is just n squared. That comes from a simple one-loop diagram. And this n squared is very intuitively explained as saying, well, it's a theory of n by n matrices, so obviously they're n squared degrees of freedom. They're n squared fields. And the n cubed cannot possibly, be explained away with such a one-line argument. And this has kind of given rise to a whole industry of people trying to count various objects in the theory to try to find n cubed, because the idea is that this thing counts degrees of freedom. And that's a fine thing to do, but I would like to offer a slightly different perspective. 4D is special for reasons that I won't explain in detail, but 4D is special because essentially interactions don't play a huge role in determining the A anomaly. For example, as you vary the coupling constant of n equals to 4, the A anomaly doesn't change. So roughly speaking, you can always go to the free field limit, and then you're, of course, just counting fields. But in general, interactions matter, and strong interactions matter, and these theories are interacting, and they don't have a free field limit. So we should somehow understand if we can just get this n cubed, by doing a perhaps slightly less trivial computation that also takes into account the interactions. And the way to set this up in this context relies on the huge supersymmetry that's in play. So remember that if we separate a single M5 brain from the stack, that's like flowing onto the moduli space of vacua. We activate the dilaton. And then we need to somehow give a convincing argument that the change in the A anomaly, that is the coefficient of the sixth derivative term in the dilaton effective action, now goes like n squared. It goes like n squared because, you know, we're computing roughly the first derivative of n cubed. Okay, so we would like to show that the coefficient of the sixth derivative term in the dilaton effective action goes like n cubed, but this is, challenging because we have no Lagrangian description of the theory at the origin. So this is where the maximal 2-0 supersymmetry comes in. Okay, 2-0 supersymmetry or 16 supercharges actually implies that this sixth derivative coefficient is incredibly robust. It's so robust that it doesn't change even when we compactify the theory on a circle and take the circle to zero size. And what happens when you do that is that you go to a five-dimensional description involving weakly coupled Suzy-Yang-Mills theory with UN gauge group in five dimensions. And for that, you do have a Lagrangian. So this is a very powerful non-renormalization theorem that is involved here, but now we have a weak coupling computation that we can do. But unlike in four dimensions, the sixth derivative term is not determined by a one-loop calculation. It's determined by a two-loop calculation. Roughly speaking, the four derivative term comes from a one-loop calculation. The sixth derivative term comes from a two-loop calculation. And if you look at where all the n's go in the two-loop calculation, where you just integrate out W bosons as you go into the Coulomb branch in five-dimensional gauge theory, at two loops, you exactly get the n squared. Comes out completely straightforwardly from a weak coupling calculation. So
coefficient,
everything. So this doesn't mean that there's no interesting physics that remains to be understood about the NQ, but that this is a totally kind of explicit and straightforward way of reproducing it from a weak coupling calculation that involves only known ingredients.
I just understand, does that calculation give the 9-7-7 correction as well?
Oh, yeah, it gets the exact answer. Yeah, I was focusing on the n cubed. The n is not so surprising. But yeah, of course. No, that's the whole point. No, there's been, a million and one ways of understanding the leading large n result. I think this one has its advantages, but the whole point of this discussion is that it's exact. Okay, so let me stop here because I've already gone a little bit over time. I apologize. So I've described kind of a whole hodgepodge of different tools. In some sense, kind of in ascending order of difficulty for analyzing strongly coupled or perhaps even non-Lagrangian supersymmetric field theories. And we discussed super conformal multiplets and current algebras, especially the current algebra of the stress tensor supermultiplet. And finally, we coupled the stress tensor supermultiplet to background supergravity fields. And then there were some applications that we could say something about using those tools. So I discussed constraints on deformations of superconformal theories, constraints on what superconformal theories are even allowed to exist a priori, and the quantum numbers of various BPS particles in non-conformal supersymmetric theories. And in the second half, I reviewed how to put supersymmetric theories on curved manifolds and talked a little bit about different partition functions that you can compute there. And I explained how you can use the coupling to supergravity to elucidate the anomaly structure of 60 superconformal theories and give a proof of some version of the A theorem in six dimensions. So I'll stop here. Thank you, and please ask any questions now.
So the next current thing would be superconformal block, right?
Sorry?
The next step would be current,
algebra. Right, but that's too hard for me. This is all easy.
I know. So is that totally open dirt or?
No, people are starting to build the technology. I mean, they're very serious.
Is there any analysis of supercomputer locks?
Yeah, and mostly in lower dimensions. They get increasingly horrible as you go to higher dimensions. But even in, so I think in 2, 3, and 4 dimensions, there's been quite a bit of work. I know people are looking at 5 and 60. There is some work on superconformal bootstrap even in 60, but I think they kind of sidestep the issue of getting the full block expansion in all its gory detail. Don't ask me about the exact details, but so partial results are known even in 60. But, this whole, this is a big industry, so I'm sure people are going to do it. The trouble is not seeing the forest for the trees, because superconformal blocks are complicated, crossing equations are complicated. I think it's kind of important to try to look at the individual pieces and really understand the physics of each one of them.
I just wanted to ask some general questions about non-Lagrangian theories. So first of all, when we talk about the 6D theories, we say there's no known Lagrangian description. I assume that means there's no Lagrangian description, even if we drop requirements of manifest contour asymmetry, manifest gauge invariance, all that kind of thing.
So for the free chiral tensor, there's an actual analogous to this one. But for the interacting theories, nothing is known.
My question just in general is there any reason to expect that theories that really don't have any Lagrangian description have any properties that are different from other theories? Meaning, if I came to a quantum field theory somehow, is there any proof strategy you can imagine to prove that it has no Lagrangian description?
That's hard. It's very hard to prove that the theory has no Lagrangian description.
Well, one characteristic might be there's no limit or regime where you have classical limit.
But I mean, does this theory have a classical limit? Does this theory have a? Well, the coefficient of this coefficient is. That was the chiral boson. The coefficient of that is kind of quantized in a sense. Right. It's tricky.
But it still can get.
There's a historical precedent here, right? Which is that for the longest time, many people thought that the M2 brain theory also couldn't have a Lagrangian, and there were some people trying to argue that one would never be able to find one, and then smart people wrote a Lagrangian. So the situation
in 60s. You can't manifest a Swain symmetry.
I'll take it, okay? this was the very subleading question. Yeah, I agree, of course, but. For example, there's an intuitive argument due to Witten that says that if you compactify from 60 to 5D, you get 5D Young-Mills, and the 5D gauge coupling, which sits in the denominator of the Young-Mills Lagrangian, it turns out to be the compactification radius. So that was given as an example of something that you wouldn't expect if you had a Lagrangian, you just integrated it over a circle. But that's true even of the free theory. For the free theory, there is a Lagrangian, and it turns out that if you work with this Lorentz invariant action, that comes out perfectly. There are papers by Greg Moore explaining how to do this in great detail. So, these are plausibility arguments. They're not bulletproof.
By the way, does all this formalism reprove the phi to the 4 or the d phi to the 4 or phi to the 4 normalization theorem for any 4?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
What about the next one, the B to the 6th term?
Yes, also. Yeah, you can organize all these things in a very streamlined language using this step of, I actually wrote a paper with Claire Cordova and she, and where we explained how to do that in this language. All these results by Safsetti and Green and But they had to work very hard.
Yes.
And some of these are like two-line arguments.
Any other questions? And now let's take a conversation.